Welcome, beloved family members, to today's exploration. We're really incredibly glad you're here with us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to be here.
So usually when we talk about time management, there is this immense expectation of absolute control.
Right, like buying a fresh new planner.
Exactly. You color code your calendar blocks, you set your alarms, and you just feel this deep satisfaction.
You look at it and think you've mastered time.
Right. You say to yourself, there it is. I have mastered my time. But our mission today is to completely dismantle that illusion. We are exploring a deeply powerful sermon by Pastor Jichon Kim, centered around Psalm 90, specifically verses 10 through 12. And we want to rescue these verses from being just another self-help cliche.
Which honestly is incredibly common. People read that ancient text, teach us to number our days, and they immediately translate it into modern productivity speak.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, hustle harder.
Exactly. The takeaway somehow becomes life is short. Make every second count, maximize your 24 hours.
But going through this sermon, I realized it turns that entirely upside down. I mean, this isn't about hacking your schedule or squeezing more emails into your afternoon.
Not at all.
It's about redefining what it actually means to exist as a fragile human being in relation to eternity. It's a journey from lament to profound wisdom and ultimately to a very specific kind of prayer.
And, well, to start that journey, we have to fundamentally change how we perceive motion. Before we can even begin to talk about how we manage time, we have to understand what is actually moving.
Right, which sounds simple, but it really isn't.
No, it's not. There is a very specific, easily overlooked phrasing that Moses uses in this biblical text
Yeah.
that flips our normal assumptions right on their head.
Because we say things like time flies all the time. You hear it at the end of a long weekend
Oh,
or
crap.
when a kid graduates high school. Where did the time go? Time just flew by.
But the sermon points out that Moses doesn't actually say that.
No, he doesn't. He says, we fly away.
We fly away. That's heavy. It forces a complete psychological reset. We fly away is a metaphor for human perishing and fading.
Right.
It's an acknowledgement that time isn't this external object zooming past us while we stand perfectly still on the riverbank. We are the ones in motion.
Our existence is what is swiftly
Yeah,
passing.
exactly. And what the sermon brings out here is how deeply we resist this truth. I mean, intellectually, we know we are mortal.
Sure, we know we're going to die eventually.
But emotionally, we reject it. We live our day-to-day lives as if we are permanent fixtures in the universe.
It almost feels like, let me think how to picture this. You know when you're sitting on a fast-moving train?
Yeah, looking out the window.
Right, you're in your comfortable seat, sipping a coffee. You look out the window and you think, look at those trees flying by. Look at those mountains flying by. It feels like the landscape is doing the moving.
And yet the landscape is entirely static.
Yes, the trees are perfectly still.
You project your own motion onto the world around you because, well, acknowledging your own velocity is uncomfortable.
I'm the one hurtling down the track toward the end of the line. The train is my life, and I am the one flying away.
And applying that visual explains why we build such strong psychological defenses. It is terrifying to admit that we are the ones hurtling toward an end.
Right, so we buy sports cars or we obsess over our legacies.
We build massive companies, all to convince ourselves that we are the landscape, not the passenger.
Wow.
But true wisdom begins not with despair, but with the sober, grounded acknowledgement of our own perishing. When you deny your own perishing, you live under the exhausting delusion that you have to build an eternal empire here and now.
So acknowledging our fading isn't supposed to be depressing, because honestly, thinking about hurtling toward the end of the line sounds a bit grim to me.
It can sell that way, yeah.
But you're saying it's actually a freeing reality check.
Absolutely. It removes an impossible burden. You don't have to be eternal. You don't have to build an indestructible empire because you just aren't built for one.
That's really freeing.
Acknowledging your limits is the starting line for true wisdom. To cross that starting line, however, we have to change how we measure the journey itself.
Because when you realize you're the one hurtling down the track, it completely breaks the way we normally measure our lives, doesn't it?
It does. The sermon argues our default measurement is fundamentally flawed. We naturally obsess over counting years.
Right. We celebrate our age in years.
We measure our career achievements in years. We
Yeah.
calculate our retirement funds based on decades. Our entire societal structure is built on annual reviews and five-year plans.
Oh man, where do you see yourself in 5 years? It's the classic interview question. I'm totally guilty of thinking this way.
We all are. But there is a distinct psychological consequence to that framing. Viewing your life in decades or years gives you a false sense of abundant time.
Like you have all the time in the world.
Exactly. It breeds a certain type of arrogance. Mm. You start to think, oh, I have plenty of time to figure this out. Plenty of time to mend that broken relationship.
Or plenty of time to get serious about my spiritual life.
Right. It creates an illusion of infinite leisure. But the sermon emphasizes the biblical instruction to count our days. The plea is, teach us to number our days.
Why days, though? Why is zooming in on that specific unit of measurement so crucial?
In the biblical context, a day is the fundamental unit of obedience and dependence. Think about the Israelites wandering in the wilderness.
Okay.
When God provided food, he didn't give them a year's supply of manna to stockpile in a massive warehouse.
Oh, right. Manna was literally daily bread provided directly from heaven.
Exactly. If they tried to hoard it out of anxiety for the future, it would rot. They had to rely on him for exactly what they needed for that specific single day.
That requires a completely different mindset. I mean, you can't lean on your savings account in that scenario.
You are forced into a daily relationship of trust. And you see this principle in the New Testament as well.
Mm.
Jesus commands his disciples in Luke 9:23 to take up their cross daily.
Daily, not yearly.
Right. Counting days strips away the illusion of a guaranteed future. It brings an intense gravity, focus, and value to today. Faith is a matter of today.
Okay, I have to push back here for a second just to play devil's advocate.
Sure, go ahead.
Someone listening might be thinking, wait, so are we not supposed to plan for the future? Should I just cash out my retirement savings and stop making my 10-year business plan because I'm only supposed to care about today?
That is a very common anxiety when discussing this concept. But the sermon isn't telling us to abandon financial responsibility or long-term goals.
Okay, good.
The contrast being drawn is between the daily posture of our hearts and the arrogance of assuming tomorrow is owed to us.
I see.
You can have a 10-year plan, but you must hold it with open hands, recognizing that today is the only space where actual obedience, actual love, and actual living take place.
It's about not letting the comfort of your 10-year plan put your spiritual life to sleep today.
Exactly. Holding it with open hands.
So if we are focusing entirely on the present day, does that just mean we should adopt that classic carpe diem mindset? You know, seize the day, YOLO, you only live once. Go wild.
The sermon offers a resounding no to that. And it uses a genuinely fascinating philosophical angle to explain why.
Oh, I love the philosophical angles.
It brings in the thoughts of Augustine, who argued that time isn't a material thing. It's not an object you can put in a box or grab hold of.
Right.
He described time as an extension of the soul.
Okay, let's unpack that. Time as an extension of the soul.
When you really think about it, what is the past? The past doesn't exist anywhere in the physical universe right now. You can't point to it.
No, I guess it only exists in your memory.
Right. So Augustine says the past is just the present of memory.
Oh, wow. And what about the future?
It hasn't happened yet. Yeah. It only exists in your mind as anticipation. So the future is just the present of expectation.
So everything is just the present. I'm trying to wrap my head around this. If everything is the present, shouldn't it be easy to seize it?
The catch is that the actual present, the literal moment you and I are experiencing right now, is incredibly fleeting.
It's just a split second.
It is a razor-thin, constantly vanishing edge. A second arrives, and before you can even process it, it's gone. It's already the past.
Which means you can't really hold on to it.
Because of this, the whole concept of carpe diem, of grabbing the present by the collar and squeezing all the juice out of it, is physically and philosophically impossible.
Wow, wait. It's like trying to hold river water in your bare hands.
That captures it beautifully.
You squeeze your hands together, you think you've got it, and it just slips right through your fingers. You physically can't hold the water.
You cannot hold the river water. It will always slip away if you try to clutch it. You just end up with empty hands.
So the question becomes, if you can't seize the present, what can you do?
According to the sermon, the core takeaway is that the only thing we can actively do in the fleeting present is pay attention. We must pay attention to the direction our soul is facing.
So instead of trying to clutch the water in our hands, we should just be checking which way the river is flowing.
Exactly. Where is your soul pointing in this exact vanishing moment? Is it pointed toward God? Toward love? Toward truth?
Or is it pointed toward greed, anxiety, and self-preservation?
Right. That directionality is the only way a fragile, fading human being can meaningfully engage with a present they cannot keep. If you are anxious, your soul is living the present of expectation.
And if you're depressed or resentful, your soul is stuck in the present of memory.
Realigning your soul's direction brings you back to the razor-thin edge of the actual present.
That is such a heavy, beautiful thought to sit with. And realizing that we can't hold on to the water, that we are entirely unable to stop time from passing, brings us face to face with our own severe limitations.
It really does.
The sermon notes that Moses perfectly captured these limitations in four stark realities.
Moses does not sugarcoat the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
These four realities act as a profound sequential reality check.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is about perspective. He states that from God's eternal perspective, 1,000 years is like a fleeting yesterday.
Which immediately shrinks our ego. To us, 1,000 years is an incomprehensible era. It's the rise and fall of entire civilizations.
We build monuments hoping they last a fraction of that.
Yeah.
But to God, it's just a blip.
Yeah.
Mm.
And moving to the second reality, it gets even more personal, doesn't it?
It does. Moses points out that humans and all of our incredible hard-fought achievements eventually return to dust.
The dust reclaims them.
No matter what physical empires or digital legacies we try to build, the dust reclaims them. It directly challenges our modern obsession with leaving a legacy. We spend our lives trying to build something permanent on Earth.
Right. We spend so much energy trying to make our mark to be remembered. Tech billionaires are pouring fortunes into trying to live forever or upload their consciousness.
But the dust is undefeated.
It's a harsh truth. What is the third reality?
We are like flowers. We bloom beautifully in the morning, and by evening, we wither and dry up.
This addresses our physical reality and aging, right?
Exactly. We spend billions of dollars on youth serums, strict diets, and exhaustive workout routines trying to freeze our morning bloom.
But the rapid cycle of life and death is undeniable. The fading flower. Mm. It really makes you rethink what you place your value in, especially in a culture so obsessed with youth.
For sure.
And then there's the fourth reality. This is the one that really caught me off guard. The sermon highlights Moses, saying that we try to use time as a hiding place for our sins, but God's light exposes everything.
Yes.
Using time as a hiding place for sins. That is a terrifying phrase. How do we do that?
Well, think about how people usually deal with deep guilt or past failure.
Uh-huh.
We think, well, that happened 10 years ago. It's in the past. Time has buried it.
The person I was back then is gone. We use the sheer volume of passing years as a thick blanket to cover our shame.
Exactly. We hide in the distance of time, relying on the psychology of repression.
Because we experience time sequentially, we assume distance in time equals distance from the action. If it was a long time ago, it feels less real to us.
But God does not experience time sequentially like we do. As we established with the first reality, to an eternal God, 1,000 years is like a day.
So your mistake from 10 years ago isn't buried under a decade of dirt.
To God, it is as present and visible as what you did this morning. The sermon explains that an eternal God sees all of time at once. The light of his face penetrates every shadowed corner of our past.
Wow. Time simply cannot hide us from eternity.
It can't.
So our achievements turn to dust. Our physical bodies wither like evening flowers. Our perspective of 1,000 years is completely flawed. And we can't even use the passing years to hide our failures.
If you're really absorbing this, you might feel like you're completely out of options. Every avenue of human self-reliance is blocked.
That feeling of being completely out of options, that's the intentional turning point of the text, isn't it?
It is. This intense reality check explains why the sermon stresses that Psalm 90 is ultimately a psalm of prayer. Human effort fails entirely against these four realities.
No amount of productivity hacks, no meticulously color-coded planner can save you from becoming dust.
Or shield your flaws from an eternal creator. We cannot live rightly or permanently on our own strength.
So we have to pivot. We hit a wall and we have to look up.
Recognizing these four realities leaves us with only one logical, wise response.
Hmm.
We must seek God's help daily. It pushes us to our knees.
True wisdom isn't figuring out how to beat the clock or outsmart your mortality.
It's realizing you cannot do either and praying for grace.
Okay, but with all this talk of fading, dust, withering flowers, and exposed mistakes, beloved family members listening might feel a bit heavy right now. Honestly, it sounds a bit bleak.
It can definitely feel that way.
If human effort is so futile, where is the hope in this sermon? Where is the light at the end of this very short, fast-moving train ride?
The hope is found in the specific nature of Moses' prayer. He doesn't deny the withering reality.
He doesn't ask God to pretend we aren't fading.
Or to turn us back into morning flowers.
Yeah.
Yet, From the very center of that dust and fragility, he prays a very bold prayer. He asks God, make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us and for as many years as we have seen evil.
Make us glad. He actually asks for joy right in the middle of the perishing.
True joy doesn't come from ignoring the fact that we are fading. It doesn't emerge from distracting ourselves with those youth serums or legacy building projects to pretend we are immortal.
So where does it come from?
The unique joy of the believer happens precisely because the eternal God chooses to intervene in our short fading days.
Let me make sure I'm grasping this. It's almost a paradox. It is exactly our fragility, exactly our limited numbered days that makes God's intervention so incredibly meaningful.
Yes, exactly.
If we lived forever, if we were eternal on our own strength, God stepping into our day wouldn't be a miracle. It would just be two immortals hanging out.
That's a great way to put it. Our emptiness serves as the vessel for his eternity. When we count our days, recognizing how few and fragile they actually are, and fix our soul's direction on God, we find a joy that far surpasses the emptiness of our temporary existence.
God's grace fills the fleeting moment. It anchors the flying train.
When you know you are held by the Eternal One, you don't have to panic about the passing days. You can finally rest in the present, even as it slips through your fingers like river water.
Because you know the river is flowing into the ocean of God's grace.
Beautifully said.
Let's recap the journey of this incredibly rich discussion. We started by looking at a shallow, self-help view of time, the illusion that time is just a resource to be managed, hacked, and maximized.
But the wisdom of this sermon completely dismantled that. We realized that time isn't just flying by us. We are the ones flying away.
We explored the vital difference between counting our years, which breeds arrogance, and the illusion of infinite time, and counting our days,
which anchors us in the daily obedience of faith, much like relying on daily manna in the wilderness.
We tackled the impossibility of carpe diem. Guided by Augustine's philosophy, we learned that you can't physically seize a fleeting present. The only thing we can control is the direction of our soul.
And finally, we confronted Moses' four realities of emptiness. We accepted that we are dust, that time cannot hide our flaws, and that our only true recourse is prayer.
And it is in that exact posture of humble prayer that we find profound eternal joy right in the middle of our fleeting lives.
Oh, true.
Remember that color-coded planner we talked about at the start? Today is not just another block on that planner to fill with productivity.
No, it's not.
Today is a singular, unrepeatable opportunity to align your soul's direction. It is a moment for the eternal to touch the fragile.
Let go of the need to build an immortal empire today. Just check the direction of the river.
As we wrap up our exploration of this beautiful sermon, I want to leave you with a final lingering question to ponder on your own.
It's a powerful one to end on.
We spend so much time obsessed with our biological age, counting the years we've been on this earth. But what if we measured our lives differently? If you were to measure your lifespan not by the biological years you've been alive, but only by the individual days your soul was truly pointed in the right direction, how old would you be today?
Such a profound question to reflect on.
Maybe the best thing you can do today isn't to add another task to your list, but to close your planner, sit quietly, and just let yourself be held by the one who holds eternity. Thank you so much for joining us on this discussion, beloved family members. Keep asking the deep questions and take care.